Welcome to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, July 10th, 2016. The Reverend Henry Sun is preaching. The sermon today is Scout's Honor. The gospel lesson is Matthew 5, verses 43 through 48, and the epistle lesson today is from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 17.
One of the things that I always find interesting in an election season is how the media can appear to play favorites with one candidate or the other. In both 2008 and 2012, I remember hearing reports that the liberal mainstream media, famously designated the lamestream media by Sarah Palin, were deliberately hiding or choosing not to report stories that supported Senator McCain or Governor Romney, or that would have hurt Senator Obama. So in order to balance this imbalance in 2016, I offer three stories for your consideration. Slide two, please. Hillary's ties to the KKK, unreported by the media. At the bottom it says, can you imagine the media coverage of if Trump's mentor was a KKK leader at age 30 and a segregationist at age 50? Watch as Hillary Clinton praises her friend and mentor, Robert Byrd. Slide three, please. Here's a picture of a welcome sign in West Virginia. Now, I do admit, as a pragmatic pacifist, I'm not sure how welcoming this sign is, but our citizens have concealed weapons. If you kill someone, we will kill you back. We have zero jails, 513 cemeteries. Have a great day. Slide four, please. Obama takes the oath of office on a Quran and a Bible. And in the bottom it says, two books to swear upon. Ah, the Quran over the Bible. Is the picture getting any clearer for you now? Now, as someone who leans center, center-left, politically and theologically, I have to admit, these stories give me the heebie-jeebies. Donald Trump was ripped by the mainstream media because his father consorted with KKK types. Why does Hillary get a free pass? No jails, but 513 cemeteries in Mingo County, thanks to the unfettered ownership of guns? And although I'm a Christian who tries to be respectful of other religions, I'm just a bit uncomfortable with the idea of a president taking the oath of office on a Quran instead of on a Bible. So I wonder, how many of you have a similar reaction to these images and stories? Or from the other side, how many of you could be sitting there with just the tiniest bit of righteous smugness? It's about time that Hillary got hers. The Second Amendment does work. It does protect us. And we finally have definitive historical proof of Obama's sneaky, covert Islamicism. There's just one problem with these reactions, positive or negative. Every one of these pictures and every one of the narratives that accompanied them are 100% completely false. They are untrue. They were made up. They were concocted to prove a point. So slide five, please. Robert Byrd was actually born in 1917. He did found a chapter of the KKK in 1942. He disavowed his membership in the KKK in 1943, and he spent virtually the rest of his political career apologizing for his mistake, including authoring a 700-page autobiography in which he talks about how that one mistake haunted him for the rest of his political career. Next slide, please. Okay, so 42 years old. Very good. The year I was born. I wonder if there's a connection here. The sign from West Virginia was actually photoshopped. Now, the sign on the left is what it originally looks like. The sign on the right is a second version of this photoshopped sign. You see where it says entering Wood County? The shadows seem to have changed colors. So it is clear that whatever that sign in West Virginia was, it was not an advertisement for the Second Amendment. Next slide, please. It's true that Obama had two books for his oath of office, but Fox News reported he used two Bibles, not a Quran and a Bible. The Bible that he placed on top, apparently, I don't know, it wasn't there, was the Bible from Abraham Lincoln, from when he freed the slaves. So how is it that we rational people will accept some claim or statement as true? In fact, as true as truth can be, when in fact it's utterly and totally wrong. So I want you to think, hold that question in your mind for a second. Now, every once in a while, someone gives me something that provides such clarity of perspective that I have to share it with others. You're the others today. One of these gifts was given to me a couple of weeks ago by my good friend and brother in the faith, Art Stein. It's a narrative about what has come to be known as L'Affaire Dreyfus, or the Dreyfus Affair. And it's the central focus of a TED Talk by Professor Julia Gallus. Slide 8, please. We're going to watch about 4 minutes of this. The presentation is called Why You Think You're Right, Even When You're Wrong. And as you're listening, I want you to pay attention especially to the difference between a soldier's mindset and a scout's mindset. So if we could go to the video, please.
What's really there as accurately as possible.
I'm sorry, I played this early. Can you go back to the beginning?
In a real, actual army, both the soldier and the scout are essential. But you can also think of each of these roles as a mindset, a metaphor for how all of us...
That's okay. My bad.
So, I'd like you to imagine for a moment that you're a soldier in the heat of battle. Maybe you're a Roman foot soldier, or a medieval archer, or maybe you're a Zulu warrior. Regardless of your time and place, there are some things that are constant. Your adrenaline is elevated, and your actions are stemming from these deeply ingrained reflexes, reflexes rooted in a need to protect yourself and your side and to defeat the enemy. So now, I'd like you to imagine playing a very different role, that of the scout. So the scout's job is not to attack or defend. The scout's job is to understand. The scout is the one going out, mapping the terrain, identifying potential obstacles. And the scout may hope to learn that, say, there's a bridge in a convenient location across a river. But above all, the scout wants to know what's really there as accurately as possible. And in a real, actual army, both the soldier and the scout are essential. But you can also think of each of these roles as a mindset, a metaphor for how all of us process information and ideas in our daily lives. And what I'm going to argue today is that having good judgment, making accurate predictions, making good decisions, is mostly about which mindset you're in. So, to illustrate these mindsets in action, I'm going to take you back to 19th century France, where this innocuous-looking piece of paper launched one of the biggest political scandals in history. It was discovered in 1894 by officers in the French general staff, and it was torn up in a waste paper basket, but when they pieced it back together, they discovered that someone in their ranks had been selling military secrets to Germany. So they launched a big investigation, and their suspicions quickly converged on this man, Albert Dreyfus. He had a sterling record, no past history of wrongdoing, no motive, as far as they could tell. But Dreyfus was the only Jewish officer at that rank in the army. And unfortunately, at this time, the French army was highly anti-Semitic. So they compared Dreyfus's handwriting to that on the memo and concluded that it was a match. Even though outside professional handwriting experts were much less confident in the similarity, but never mind that. They went and searched Dreyfus's apartment, looking for any signs of espionage. They went through his files, and they didn't find anything. And this just convinced them more that Dreyfus was not only guilty, but sneaky as well, because clearly he had hidden all of the evidence before they had managed to get to it. Next, they went and looked through his personal history for any incriminating details. They talked to his teachers. They found that he had studied foreign languages in school, which clearly showed a desire to conspire with foreign governments in later in life. His teachers also said that Dreyfus had a good memory, known for having a good memory, which was highly suspicious, right? You know, because a spy has to remember a lot of things. So the case went to trial, and Dreyfus was found guilty. And afterwards, they took him out into this public square and ritualistically tore his insignia from his uniform and broke his sword in two. This was called the degradation of Dreyfus. And they sentenced him to life imprisonment on the aptly named Devil's Island, which is this barren rock off the coast of South America. So there he went, and there he spent his days alone, writing letters and letters to the French government, begging them to reopen his case so they could discover his innocence. But for the most part, France considered the matter closed. So one thing that's really interesting to me about the Dreyfus affair is this question of why the officers were so convinced that Dreyfus was guilty. I mean, you might even assume that they were setting him up, that they were intentionally framing him, but historians don't think that's what happened. As far as we can tell, the officers genuinely believed that the case against Dreyfus was strong.
Okay, thank you.
Which, you know, makes you wonder, what does it say about the human mind that we can find such paltry evidence?
Okay. Galef reminds us, if we can have the curtains pulled, please, Jim. Galef reminds us that there is a certain mentality that lies at the heart of a soldier's mindset. Later on, she will say, some information, some ideas feel like allies. We want them to win. We want to defend them. Other information or ideas are the enemy. We want to shoot them down. Our judgment is strongly influenced unconsciously by which side we want to win. And this is ubiquitous. It shapes how we think about our health, our relationships, how we decide to vote, and what we consider fair or ethical. And so, part of the problem that we have in why the church needs to rehab its brand is that we, all of us, we want our side to win. It's really just that simple. We want to win. We don't want to lose. In fact, we hate to lose. And so we will do anything to win, even twisting facts and making up evidence to fit the winning narrative we've already constructed in our minds, just like the French did with Captain Dreyfus. The sports culture that we live in feeds this ideology that win is good and lose is bad. The Warriors just set a record for the most wins in a regular season, right? 73 wins, 9 losses. And most wins in a regular season and a playoff, 88 wins. No one has ever done that before. Over the course of 106 total games, the Warriors lost 18. In contrast, I'm happy to say, the Lakers lost 9 games before Thanksgiving. Yay for the Lakers. The Kings lost their 18th game in December. And yet, many have concluded that the Dubs' season was a failure because they didn't win the championship. In the same way, the 2007 New England Patriots, who won 18-1, the 2001 Seattle Mariners, who won 116 games, and, pains me to say, the 1993 San Francisco Giants, who won 103 games, are all commonly viewed as failures. Why? Because the Patriots lost to the Giants in the Super Bowl. The Mariners lost to the Yankees in the playoffs. They didn't even make it to the World Series. The Giants, they didn't even make it to the playoffs. Since, next slide please, winning equals good, right? And, next slide please, losing equals bad. These teams are losers with a capital L, because they didn't end up being champions, right? Indeed, next slide please. There is nothing worse in America than being labeled a loser. Even Jesus is in on it. You see, my friend, you're a loser. Even Jesus gets in on it. Now, Not only does our competitive sports culture feed this soldier's mentality, our political discourse feeds it also. Next slide, please. In 1991, University of Professor James Davison Hunter published this book called Culture Wars. And to the right is a description of it. And what I had never seen before is this. Look at all the war language in the description. Culture Wars presents a riveting account of how Christian fundamentalists, Orthodox Jews, and conservative Catholics have joined forces in a fierce battle against their progressive counterparts, secularist Reformed Jews, liberal Catholics and Protestants. As each side struggles to gain control over such fields of conflict as the family, art, education, law, and politics. Not since the Civil War has there been such fundamental disagreements about truth, freedom, and our national identity. Then, next slide please, in 1992, Patrick J. Buchanan at the Houston, Texas GOP nominating convention would invoke this language of the culture war in his speech. This election is much more than who gets what. It is about who we are. It's about what we believe. It's about what we stand for as Americans. There is a religious war going on in our country for the soul of America. It is a cultural war, as critical to the kind of nation we will one day be as was the Cold War itself. And it is in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on the other side, and George Bush is on our side. We have to come home. We have to stand beside him. And so for the last 3 days, Americans have been at war with other Americans about something. Next slide, please. Abortion, right to bear arms, gay marriage, transgender in bathrooms, etc., and etc., and etc. Yesterday, I went to one of my websites called Real Clear Politics. Next slide, please. Here's a screenshot of what it says, which you can't read. So I have selected some of the language for you. False racism. Republican attacks. Hillary Clinton disqualifies herself. Admiration for dictators. Police shooting black men. Blame Black Lives Matters. Exploit attack to push for gun control. Finally, our Christian tradition feeds the mindset as well. This morning's passage from Ephesians 6 urges Christians to put on the full armor of God because we are at war. We are at war. Elsewhere, Paul describes us as fellow soldiers. Christians sing hymns like Onward Christian Soldiers. Theologians write about the church militant. The Old Testament talks about Yahweh being the Lord of the heavenly armies. Daniel in the Old Testament and Revelation in the New Testament invoke apocalyptic imagery in the service of this final cosmic triumph of the chosen ones over the godless heathen. We talk about holiness and righteousness as something we decide on God's behalf. And then we label those whom we judge to be heretics as being a threat to the faith or enemies of the faith. And we justify it all on the basis of the Bible's warning against false teachers in Matthew 7 and 2 Peter 2. Next slide, please. Beware the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. Or false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive opinions. They will even deny the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Even so, many will follow their licentious ways, and because of them, the way of truth will be maligned. So, how does all of this fit into last week's sermon about the church's mission of making disciples and the church's ministry of reconciliation? Why spend so much time on such a beautiful Sunday morning talking about this win at all costs because winners are good and losers are losers mentality? Well, suppose we ordinary Christians in our ordinary lives take this soldier's mindset into our relationships with ordinary people who aren't yet followers of Jesus. Does the be right at all cost mentality help persuade these people to give grace a chance? Does the winners are good and losers are losers mentality help persuade others with a different point of view to be open to the gospel. Does the right is right, wrong is wrong, and I absolutely know for sure which is which and who is who, does that mentality do anything other than convince those who haven't given Christ a chance that the church's one and only job is to figure out who's right and who's in, and who's wrong and who's out? To be blunt, does a soldier's mentality help us to fulfill our mission of making disciples or to fulfill our ministry of reconciliation? I submit to you this morning that most of the damage that we've done to our brand stems from the fact that both sides of the spectrum, not the one and not the other, but both, are more and more populated by soldiers advocating for a cause and less by scouts seeking to understand the other side. Remember what the duty of the soldier is. Defend the motherland from its enemies. Obey without hesitation or doubt. Conquer and root out evil. It is the very nature of a soldier's mentality to see the world in terms of us versus them. Purely black and white. Absolutely right or wrong. But the problem is that this isn't our primary mission. If it were, the parable of the Good Samaritan might have read like this. Apologies in advance for choosing the easy caricatures. And Jesus spoke this parable saying, some dude was walking along the road when he was ambushed by a cop who tased him, beat him, shot him, and left him for dead. Along came a firebrand conservative blogger who wrote that the cop feared for his safety because the dude was combative and resistant and threatening. He walked away with hundreds and thousands of his followers liking his post and sharing it with their friends. Then along came a bleeding heart liberal who also blogged about the incident, writing that even though dude had a prior record and was carrying a toy gun, the cop could have de-escalated the situation, arguing that the incident reflects a systemic pattern of police brutality that must be confronted, addressed, and changed. He too walked away with thousands of followers giving him a thumbs up and sharing his post with their friends. Finally, the dude died in the road. Truly, I say to you, my Father who art in heaven will tell the one blogger, well done, my good and faithful servant, while banishing the other to eternal torment in the lake of fire. When we allow the soldier's mentality of right versus wrong, win versus lose, and us versus them to become the church's top priority, we lose sight of what is the church's actual top priority. For example, next slide, please. Yes, teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? You shall love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Next slide, please. You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the children of your Father in heaven. Next slide, please. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Next slide, please. And don't forget about the parable of the sheep and the goats, or the real parable of the Good Samaritan. We can begin to rehab our brand here in Vallejo and in Solano County to the extent that we believe that love is always our highest and most important priority, and we act on that belief. When the soldier's mentality of being right at all times, in all places, and at all costs threatens to usurp this higher priority of love, we must work to keep it in check, lest we continue to damage our brand and needlessly hinder our mission of making disciples and our ministry of reconciliation. Amen.
You have been listening to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Community Presbyterian Church and its ministries, come visit us at 2800 Georgia Street, in Vallejo, California. Or visit our website, cpcvallejo.org. You can also email us at cpcvallejo@sbcglobal.net. Have a blessed day.